Welcome to Control Intelligence, the control design conversation that goes deep inside the automation and technology that machine builders and system integrators rely on to keep machines humming. I'm Mike Bassador, Editor-in-Chief of Control Design, and in this episode, I'm joined by Jeff Bernstein, who's the president of the Association for Advancing Automation, the North American trade group representing almost 1,500 companies involved in robotics, artificial intelligence, machine vision, motion control, and related automation technologies. Jeff joined the association in 1983 and has held a variety of senior positions, culminating in his promotion to president in 2007. He's a frequent commentator on automation issues to the media, policymakers, and the public, and he regularly speaks at global conferences on topics such as the latest automation trends, the impact of automation on jobs, and the future of automation beyond the factory floor. In 2003, he received the Engelberger Robotics Award for leadership. Jeff, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike.
So having joined the Robotics Industries Association back in 1983, before it became part of the Association for Advancing Automation, and witnessing that period when early robotic expectations outpaced their technical capabilities, what practical lessons translate from those early adoption cycles when you're evaluating the emerging technology that we're seeing in, say, physical AI and humanoids?
It's a great question, Mike. What I learned during that period in the early to mid 80s and into the 90s, companies got excited about the possibilities of robotics. But when they actually went to install them, they ran into a whole bunch of issues. One was they were too complicated. One was they were too costly. One was we don't have really people that know what to do with them. We don't really have the use cases well defined yet. So there were a lot of issues that held back the development of the robotics industry. Ultimately, even though it started out, it was going to be the next industrial revolution, then it was a failure. But ultimately, industrial robots became a significant industry globally, and they still are today. But this is how I evaluate when I see the hype around humanoids, frankly. Are the use cases there? Is the reliability there? Is the ROI there? These are the questions that the humanoid companies are faced with and they're going to have to answer. And I think it's going to be still a few years before we start to see them at any meaningful scale, at least in the US.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it for me, that transition was from looking at robotics as a machine, you know, say 10, 15 years ago, and now it's really almost become a component that a lot of machine builders, at least, are using in other applications where they might have a machine and then the robot is actually implemented as part of the cell, for whether it's for tending or welding or painting or whatever the case might be. But they've become so commonplace, so affordable, so easy to program that they've really become just a part of automation.
I agree. They've become part of solutions.
And absolutely.
Companies understand what they want to achieve. Here's the solution. It's not just a robot. It's more than a robot.
Right.
And,
yes.
You know, now with the emergence of AI that is able to make the robot part of the solution even smarter, there are a lot of benefits to traditional industrial robots right now that maybe weren't even there decades ago, but certainly are now.
Absolutely.
And that's why there's such a home for these traditional type of robots.
Right. Absolutely. So you started your career in communications before taking the helm of A3 in 2007. So talking the technology language is not Greek to you. How can OEMs and integrators better communicate the ROI and economic necessity of automation to non-technical executive teams and even skeptical end users?
Well, actually, the technology terms were Greek to me, and they still to a large extent are. It's not my background. My background is trying to explain the question that you just asked. Why should a company automate in the first place?
Yep.
They have issues. They have quality issues. They have productivity issues. They have shortage of people. Can automation help do the job effectively, reliably, consistently, and affordably? And if you can show a customer, here's how this looks. This is what it does. This is why you're struggling now and why this might be able to help you out. And especially in an era where there's a lack of people willing to do some of these jobs, there's definitely a shortage of people in almost every industry. So robots do the dull, dirty, dangerous jobs that people don't want to do. Robots are highly effective because they're reliable and the costs, as you said, are affordable, and they deliver the solution. Now, again, if I'm a customer, and many customers tell me this, I don't care about a robot. I'm not interested in a robot. You could tell me whatever. You have a solution for me. It doesn't have to be a robot. Just get me a solution to my problem. And if the robot is part of that, great. If not, then I don't want the thing. But more and more often, robots are a part of the solution, an important part. And that's why we've seen the industry grow.
Absolutely. You've tracked the rise of robotics adoption in other countries, Japan and China, following their national industrial strategies. How can North American companies emulate that type of success in the global market without being heavily subsidized by government?
Well, we've outlined a vision for a national strategy for the United States. And we have several points. And first one is that there needs to be a central robotics office or some point where if companies needed assistance in dealing with the government, that they could know that there was a place they could go and talk about robotics. Because robotics cuts across the Defense Department, Commerce, every part of the government. But the second point is probably the most important. We need to increase adoption in the United States. And if we could incentivize adoption, what you would be likely to see is more companies willing to come here and manufacture their products here because there's more customers here. This is what we saw in China and before that, maybe even in Japan, where because the market was so big, companies would go set up shop there. And this is true of not only the complete robot, but the components as well. So we really think ways to incentivize adoption are critical. Third one is the government in the US can be a major adopter of robotics. Right now, they use them maybe in the Defense Department, but there's all kinds of areas where we could see robots used. There's a lot of logistical tasks in the government and other places where robots might make sense. And also, if the government were a big user, it would send a message out, look, don't worry about this being a job killer, which is another issue we've faced forever. Think
Absolutely.
about the value of that message coming from the US government. We're actually a major implementer of robots because we believe in it. We're incentivizing it for others. Next thing we have to focus on, though, is this shortage of skilled labor. We can't reshore all this manufacturing. We can't increase our manufacturing. It's going to be highly automated. We know who's going to run these machines. So, how do we get enough investment in a skilled workforce? So, that's part of our recommendation. We have to invest heavily. We have to invest more in educational research, but also maybe corporate research. Maybe there's some really innovative startups that could help us advance in certain areas that could just use a little funding that isn't coming necessarily from venture capital. And then standards, big issue. We need to have standards faster. Like we do a lot in standards at A3.
Sure.
To get a global standard takes years. Well, look at how fast things are changing in AI and humanoids and all these robotic spaces. Maybe there's something that the government could do, maybe through NIST, to convene groups like ours together and say, look, here's what we see. We need something quickly because we're concerned about humanoids working around people, for instance. Why don't we have a standard for that? We think the government can play a role there. So that's what we've outlined. And we see that in countries that have a national strategy, it often increases adoption. I mean, certainly in China, you can see that way back in more than 10 years ago when they put in their Made in 2025 program. Before that, they were already thinking about how important robotics was going to be to them and building the proper supply chain. We saw it decades before that in Japan. The Ministry of Interior and Technology and Industry, whatever, MITI it's called, they had a strategy for how do we take advantage of this technology. And they succeeded and they became the world's largest user and producer of robots. Then China, that's the situation they're in now. How does the US get back into a leadership role? We think we need a national strategy.
Absolutely. You spoke a little bit about the swift change in technology that we've seen. Winning the Engelberger Robotics Award for leadership in 2023 recognized your 4-decade-long effort to advance automation. When you look back, what single technological shift surprised you the most, and what shift do you think integrators are still underestimating?
Well, recently the emergence of AI is a key factor. I mean, you think about the implications of this, that we may be going from having to program all these machines to the AI models training them. And how will we be prepared for that? This cuts across machine builders, integrators, everybody has got to figure out the role that AI is going to play going forward, whether it's humanoids or not. All the machines are getting smarter because of AI. And so this is a pretty big deal, and probably potentially the biggest deal that I've seen is this rapid advance of AI. When I started, there was talk about AI, and then there was an AI winter. So it didn't happen. But it sure seems to be happening now. And all this money that's going in and all these investments and all these companies that are, multi-billion, trillion-dollar companies. Something's going to happen here, and it's going to have a major impact. It's already having an impact on robotics, but I believe that's something everybody's going to have top of mind. How do we take advantage of it? How do we prepare? That's going to be critical.
Certainly, the push toward autonomous factories or autonomous plants will be impacted by AI and robotics, just in their ability to provide engineering capacity that is virtually limitless, because with the robot, with agentic AI and a robot able to just make decisions on maybe I should go weld. Nope, now I should go unload that machine without any human in the loop. Gives the
Potentially, yeah.
just blows up the idea of engineering capacity having a ceiling on it.
Right. So this is the kind of discussions that companies should be having if they're not. How are we going to get out front on this if this is the future?
You spoke a little bit about standards earlier, and A3 authored the landmark 1986 National Robot Safety Standard. How is A3 structuring upcoming safety standards for newer applications such as AMRs and humanoid systems in order to protect integrators from the liability while still allowing the fast-paced innovation?
Well, with every emerging form factor, we've been active in standards. We were active in collaborative robot standards. There are mobile robot standards now that we help develop. And now you're looking at humanoids. So we are active in the humanoid space, working on dynamic stability. And that's going to be critical if we're going to work around these machines. For us, safety has been the top priority from the beginning. You mentioned it went way back to 1986 when we introduced the first American National Robot Safety Standard that became the basis of the ISO global standard. It's because it's important. We don't want to see people get hurt or worse. And we take it seriously. In the early days, whenever there was an accident involving a robot, regardless of whether the robot was responsible for that accident or not, didn't matter. It had a chilling effect on the growth of the industry. It was headline news everywhere. Robot kills person. That's awful. I mean, that you want to kill your industry, you do that. Now, some of those, as I said, some of those headlines may have been misleading, but it doesn't matter. Somebody was killed or somebody was injured and a robot was somehow involved. We can't have that. And you look forward to a future of driverless cars. We saw that in the early days of driverless cars. We know that ultimately driverless cars are going to be safer than human drivers. I don't think anybody doubts that. However, pilot programs were stalled or canceled in many cities, I think, when there was an accident. So you think about that in terms of humanoids. What happens if a humanoid is in a factory and there's a fatality that involved that humanoid. That is going to have a, I think, a real chilling effect on the growth of that industry. So we need to take this seriously, and in the US, A3 certainly is.
Certainly, yes. Yeah, I mean, you have your safety conference every year. Certainly,
Yes.
you're one step ahead of everything.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit previously about that shortage of skilled workers, and machine builders certainly struggle with that shortage. And how are A3's educational and workforce initiatives helping integrators to build a sustainable talent pipeline in order to support project deployment and field service?
We're developing a whole lot of new courses on these technologies, robotics, AI, safety, so that we can reach this next generation of workers, people who, think of, manufacturing jobs as dull and, things I don't want to do and the environment isn't very appealing. You and I know, if you've been in a manufacturing facility, these places are high tech, they're clean, you just very impressive
Absolutely.
workplaces from a workplace standpoint. We need to get that message out more strongly, and we need to train people with the skills so that they can operate in those environments. Maybe they'll be maintaining the robots, maybe installing them, maybe overseeing the operations. There's a lot of tasks that people still do in an increasingly automated world. In fact, as you know, we've tracked this for decades, and what we've found is whenever robot sales have gone up in America, unemployment has gone down. And when robot sales have gone down, unemployment has gone up. In part, that's because companies who are implementing robots, which are often the best technology solution, are able to be more successful, win new business, and hire more people. And that's the what we see going forward. I know there are fears, there have always been fears since day one about these technologies taking jobs, but we think we ought to lean into the technologies in order to create new jobs to make American companies more competitive.
Absolutely. Now, you and A3 have special interest in what happens in Washington, and A3 has been actively pushing Washington for a U.S. national robotics strategy, like you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
How would such a strategy directly benefit, say, small to medium OEMs and system integrators who need tax incentives, capital investment, or even local deployment support to help their customers to reshore production?
Yeah, they need a lot of support, and they need also skilled workers. So I think all of the elements that we outlined in terms of incentivizing companies, in terms of investing in the workforce, I think small, medium-sized businesses would definitely benefit. One of the issues, in fact, in robotics on the user side is that small and medium-sized companies are still a fraction of the user base. And so we need to increase that because they're missing out on technologies that can help them, in part because they don't have the workers, in part because they don't have anybody telling them what these benefits are or incentivizing them to deal with the cost issues up front. You're new to this. It's an investment you might be worried about making because you're not sure. Would be nice to have more assistance on that issue as well. And if adoption increases significantly, like we believe it can in the US, we think we're nowhere near where robot adoption can be, then all these small and medium-sized integrators are going to benefit too, because there's going to be more work than they can handle.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the Automate Show. Probably North America for sure. It's become the largest automation show.
Yeah.
The show floor has evolved over the years from showcasing six-axis industrial arms or integrator-developed vision systems to software-driven automation, motion control, physical AI. How can integrators best structure their time at the show in order to evaluate, say, full stack ecosystem compatibility or isolated components?
Yeah, integrators, like everyone else, this show has grown so big, you really have to come to the show with a plan.
Right.
How much time do I need to see? How can I research in advance? Now, of course, we have a mobile app, but there's all kinds of information available on who the companies
Sure.
are that are going to be there and what they might be showing. So it does take some upfront homework before you get to
Absolutely.
the show to know, okay, who do I want to see? Can I make meetings in advance? Can I determine how many people from my staff should come with me? How do we accomplish everything we can? Because there's so much there. I mean,
Yes.
It's getting really difficult. In the old days, people would say, oh, I'd come for a day. Really, it's hard to come for a day anymore.
Yeah, you'd miss so much. Yeah, just coming for one day.
Yeah.
Well, with dedicated areas there, like the humanoid robot pavilion and AI showcases, how can machine builders evaluate which technologies are ready to be integrated into high throughput 24/7 manufacturing equipment versus those that are still in the prototype stages?
Yeah, that's where some of that upfront homework comes in handy because you can identify, okay, there's a pavilion of companies in an area. Which ones really would fit my needs? Like, do I need to lift heavy things? Well, then which companies are kind of focused on that? Which of these people can I make an advance appointment with to make sure that I'm going to get my questions answered? Because otherwise, you're just looking at, show demos are in a lot of ways like videos, right? They don't really tell you the story. They show you something, but you really need to talk to somebody at the company to get that story, which a lot of time can't be fully displayed at a trade show, obviously. So, but you want to make those contact. In fact, I've talked to people who were in that humanoid pavilion, and this is exactly how it went for them. Companies made advance appointments, and then some companies have come to visit them out where they are, which is far from where the show was held, to follow up because they learned something there that might have been of immediate value to them.
Awesome. As the component manufacturers continue to build integrated software and smart hardware, where do you see the Automate Show providing the most value for integrators looking to expand their offerings into new industries beyond traditional applications?
We're definitely trying to focus on new industries. This started out as a show that kind of appealed to the fact that 80% of the robots were going into the automotive industry. So you had a robot show that was highly focused on automotive applications. You look at where robots are being used today, everywhere. They're either using them or thinking about it. Agriculture and construction, life sciences, food, all these industries that really were a small fraction, if anything, on the radar screen. Well, you add up all these non-automotive industries now, I think in the most recent half of the year, 54% has been non-automotive. That's a big win for the industry because we're reaching all these other industries. So we're going to continue to see this. We want that our trade show to reflect that. We're going to have more and more demos, I believe, of robots at work in these other industries, and they're going to need integrators. They're definitely going to need integrators because, like everyone else that hasn't adopted robot technology, it's hard to get started without help. You really need to figure out who you can trust to work with and pick the right components for your solution.
Absolutely. As we mentioned, Automate draws a significant number of attendees seeking solutions. And I believe this year the final tally was well over 50,000.
Yes, well over 50,000. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are, taking a step back, what are some of the most common project scoping missteps that you see end users making? And how can integrators leverage the show in order to set some realistic expectations for, say, project lead times and custom engineering needs.
Yeah, the biggest mistake we see end users make is that they start with the most difficult project. And that's a recipe for disaster because, if it's so hard that you can't figure out how to do it with all your experience and all the people you've got working on it, probably going to be a while before a robot can figure it out. So we recommend to companies that they start smart, that they take something that if they achieved it, that could be scaled throughout the company. And then you start building on top of these wins, and then you can get to a point where you can take on more difficult projects. Because again, when you implement robots, you have the people to worry about. How are they going to react? Failures don't look good. You don't want to start with failures. You want to start with successes. So we talk about starting smart. And I think integrators probably are sharing those messages too. Like, hey, you might be biting off more than you can chew here. This is a really difficult problem. Let's get some wins under our belt.
Always a good strategy. Get that win, get a little more backing, and then move forward from there.
Yeah.
Next year, the show heads to Vegas. So, Kind of excited about that. What can we expect from the automation show or the Automate show in 2027 in Las Vegas?
Well, we think it's going to be really great based on our early signups. So every year at Automate, we sign up for the following show. And we had a record signup for the Las Vegas show. In fact, we have two halls there, and one of them is virtually sold out already, and the other one is about half full. So we're encouraging companies who are interested, be a good idea to get started signing up now before they're all gone. There's a long list of companies that haven't signed up yet. To give you some example, we had over 1,230 companies exhibit at Automate this year, and we've sold all this space with less than half of that.
Wow, that's a
So we're running out of space. We've got a lot of companies who still haven't signed up yet. So it's going to be a large show. Now, what we also think is that it's going to reach a different type of audience. We're still going to get heavy manufacturing companies that you would expect to find in the Midwest. But what we're counting on is reaching industries that we don't normally reach in large numbers that are on the West Coast, aerospace, for instance, and many others. So we feel like this is going to be a good move to be a balance. The plan is that in the even years, we'll be in Chicago, and in the odd years, we'll be in Las Vegas. Las Vegas Convention Center is big enough so that we can grow as well. So that is like Chicago at McCormick Place. We're using two halls this year, hopefully more in the future.
sure.
So we see big opportunities for growth in both facilities, but also in terms of growing the market, the people who come. Like if you're in agriculture and you want to go to the Automate show, well, you're a lot closer if you're on the West Coast to coming to a show that's in Las Vegas. That's an
Right.
example. Yeah.
Great. Really looking forward to that. So thanks for spending the time with me, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure as always.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation and always happy to chat with you, Mike.
Absolutely. Listeners, thanks for joining me on this episode of Control Intelligence. If you've enjoyed this episode of Control Intelligence, brought to you by Endeavor B2B, don't miss our older episodes and subscribe to find new podcasts in the future. You can find our podcast library at controldesign.com, or you can download all episodes on Podbean or via Apple Podcasts or Google Play. Thanks again, Jeff.
Thank you.